Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the third week of March 2018. I'm your host, Paul Rubin. Today, I'm excited to have Dr. Mark Elbrock joining us to talk about coexisting with mountain lions, their behavior, and human encroachment. Mark is an ecologist, lead scientist for Panthera, and storyteller with dual interests in animal tracking and mountain lions. He is a National Outdoor Book Award-winning author and has written fundamental books such as Peterson's Field Guide to Animal Tracking, Mammal Tracks and Sign, A Guide to North American Species, and Animal Skulls. He is also a contributor to National Geographic and has been featured by BBC, Nat Geo Wild, New York Times, National Public Radio, and The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Before Mark and I continue our conversation, let's hear this week's mystery sound and go through recent observations and news. Between the size of a robin and a crow, this resident songbird is a common sight throughout western Washington. Boasting a triangular crest on their somewhat large heads, these aggressive birds can be heard scolding other wildlife or playfully socializing while exploring the forest canopy. They sometimes instigate mobbing of predators and other possible dangerous intruders like mountain lions. You may have also noticed them hogging your bird feeder as they prepare for winter. What beautiful weather we've had here in the Olympic Peninsula recently. By the sign of it, our native flora is gearing up for spring. One hungry Anna's hummingbird and I have noticed a clump of salmonberry flowering ahead of schedule, but no one's complaining.
With moderate temperatures and wet ground, rough-skinned newts are once again appearing from underground hibernation sites to forage and mate. Their core habitat in Washington is exclusively west of the Cascades. Although this orange-bellied amphibian is friendly in appearance, they pack a poisonous punch that is 10,000 times more toxic than the gulp of cyanide. Only the common garter snake is immune to their poison, and no other predators eat them. However, in search of spring breeding ponds, they inevitably inch across roads where they are squashed by automobiles.
I think this is a good opportunity to talk briefly about something I hear often when in conversation with people. What is the difference between poisonous and venomous? The difference is passive versus aggressive behavior in wildlife and the method of entry into the body. Venomous animals inject their venom while poisonous species must be ingested or touched. In this case, rough-skinned newts are poisonous because they are deadly when ingested. Their bright orange bellies are also a sign of potentially harmful toxins, like other similar animals. I've heard these terms casually get mixed up in conversation, and I've even seen an official sign in Texas warning of poisonous snakes at the beginning of a trailhead. Unless they thought hikers were planning on touching or eating snakes, I think they also had things mixed up.
January 22nd of this year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife declared the eastern cougar extinct and removed it from the endangered species list, where it had been since 1973. There hasn't been a confirmed sighting of an eastern cougar reported in over 80 years.
Thousands of plants were planted by volunteers at Tarboo Creek last month. Hosted by the Northwest Watersheds Institute's Plantathon, 180 volunteers planted 4,300 native trees and shrubs along the perimeter of Tarboo Creek. The Plantathon became the largest environmental service project in East Jefferson County. And we're back to our topic for the week with Dr. Mark Elbrock on coexisting with mountain lions. So I'm not sure if the hot debate in my local community on Nextdoor inspired this or the funny-looking cougar you probably saw before walking into the portable today where we record. I think there's a lot of interest in the community about mountain lions because they're so elusive. They're really interesting animals. So cougar, mountain lion, puma, catamount, and panther are a few common names that are used to describe puma concolor. Can you talk for a moment about whether they are any significant differences, or is there one more correct naming convention?
Mountain lion, panther, they're all the same animal. In fact, they believe that this species has more common names than any other animal in the Americas. And this is due to the fact that they have the largest geographic range of any terrestrial mammal in the Americas, all the way from the southern part of Alaska to the southern tip of South America. And because it stretches across such a vast area, there are numerous indigenous cultures that all had their unique names for this animal. Is one more right than another? No, absolutely not. I know that here in Washington, people prefer the word cougar. I tend to say mountain lion, just having moved here from Wyoming. One is not right and the other is not wrong.
We spoke earlier about the declaration of the Eastern Cougar's extinction and removal from federally endangered protection. Was this declaration accurately reported?
Certainly it was accurately reported in the sense that it was in an official document declared extinct. What I think the media has emphasized is this extinction rather than some of the subtleties that were in the report declaring this, quote, extinction. The one I would like to emphasize is that the Eastern cougar never really existed, that all mountain lions in North America are actually the same subspecies. And therefore, although mountain lions in that part of the world, the northeast of our country, are now gone, that they are locally extinct, the Eastern cougar as a subspecies never was there in the first place. That was based on old science, and science changes over time. So back in the old days, we would try to determine subspecies status mostly by visual morphological differences across the species range. So we might measure their skull and say, well, gosh, in this part of the country, they have a slightly longer nose. And we would apply some math and say, well, gosh, it seems to be consistent that they have a longer nose. Therefore, we'll call it a subspecies. We'll call it the long-nosed mountain lion or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, we pretty much always rely on genetics. And genetics has shown consistently that in North America, all the mountain lions are the same. So they are the same subspecies of mountain lion. And so for that reason, there was no taxonomical justification for an Eastern cougar to be in existence, nor to be protected, because it is the same mountain lion as in the West.
Yeah. I think fur color, too, is another morphological indicator that they would use. And they show a lot of variation in morphology like that.
Yeah. I mean, concolor, their Latin name, puma concolor, it means single color. But if you study mountain lions, you realize that not only are individuals varied in their coloration across their coat, but mountain lions are tremendously different colors across their range, from yellow to pale to gray to almost white to brown here in Western Washington, and orangey in Idaho and parts of Wyoming. Yeah. So it's a tremendous variation.
We talked about my background in Florida, but I've done surveying for Florida panthers, and they do look different than what Western mountain lions that you would see here. But that's probably has nothing to do genetically. It's just maybe what food is available or the type of habitat that they live in or what the resources they do have available.
Well, Florida is certainly unique. In fact, there may be a genetic reason for some of their morphological differences. Yeah. So they needed to be rescued. Their population was so small that inbreeding depression occurred, and they were actually seeing morphological results from such a small population. Kinked tails, unusual facial markings. Mm-hmm. And those, some of those have persisted, some of the facial structure has persisted in the current population. And so that's one of the reasons they look a little different. Yeah.
That's good to know. And I remember there was a debate, at least amongst my friends, that they brought in new breeding populations from Texas. And is this still the same species? But it is, because it's all puma concolor. So there's really no issue with it.
Yeah, there was tremendous debate on whether it was even a good idea.
Yeah.
They brought in 8 females from Texas. Now that we can use hindsight, we can say it was a tremendous success.
Can you give us a timeline of breeding populations in Eastern North America and the main barriers for successful breeding over there?
Oh, I couldn't predict when it'll happen. Basically, right now, mountain lions are one of our greatest success stories in terms of bringing wildlife or wild animal back from near extinction to a healthy population. Mm-hmm. And that occurred ironically, and I'll say ironically because of the general perceptions about state agencies and management, but ironically, it was because we moved them from vermin status, where we could just kill as many as we want any way we wanted, to a managed species in which there were managed hunts, trophy hunting, if you will, to just use sort of general language.
Yeah.
And that's what saved the mountain lion. They were already existing in little islands in the West, surviving, holding on. But just that release from constant pressure from human sort of persecution, simultaneous with a reduce of hunting pressure on elk and deer and its other prey, those things just allowed mountain lions to blossom in a new way. And their population is doing so well that we're seeing eastern movement from the west now. So they're pushing east. Mm-hmm. How fast that is typically depends on how fast females disperse, not males. The males are the pioneers. They go further. This is in general. They go further and faster. And females, some scientists who've looked at this quite intensively think that they, on average, are expanding eastward about 25 miles per year. Mm-hmm. So you could see it's a lot of years before we're going to reach the East Coast.
Yeah, I think males have a bigger range, right? They have a bigger territorial area. So they,
true.
That's why maybe they need to go a little further.
They go a little bit further. And they have larger ranges. And because males decide how big their home range should be based on the availability of females and mating opportunities. Mm-hmm. Whereas females base their home ranges on the availability of resources, meaning food and refugia and things like that.
Just to go back real quick, and then I want to talk more about this side of the country and this side of the continent, but I know in Florida, the Coosawhatchie River was the big barrier, and every now and then a male panther was crossing it, but it probably went back, or it just kind of started wandering. But for the first time, I think it was the other year, 2 years ago, a female had crossed it.
And quite recently.
That's a big deal, because now we can establish a breeding population north of the Coosawhatchie River, basically central Florida, where there hasn't been a breeding population in quite some time.
That's right. The arrival of a female was something to celebrate.
So that applies pretty much the same way to the eastern United States and into Canada for breeding populations in the east. Rather than seeing this as a negative thing, this is kind of... No breeding populations on the eastern U.S. currently, but they're expanding the range to the east from a healthy population of western mountain lion.
Correct.
So we talked about the current status of mountain lions in the west, but it doesn't seem that there are any issues. Like, the populations to come are not declining. They're actually getting better.
In the west, mountain lions and their population, the number of mountain lions in any given place is decided by us. And in general, a state's management plan for the species. In plain English, that means how many we kill.
Yeah.
And that's legal hunting, because they are a game species, a managed game species, which means there's a hunting season. There's a limit to how many that can be killed or can be killed by an individual hunter each year. And the state monitors those numbers because it is their job to maintain sustainable populations for the public trust. Overall, in the West, the states are doing just fine at maintaining the current number of mountain lions and even allowing some of those numbers to increase. Mm-hmm. The only state in the West that does not allow mountain lion hunting is California. The initial ban began in 1973. There's been various legislation since that time that has reinforced the protection. Mm-hmm. And now they are permanently protected in the state of California. That's a big state, obviously, that's protecting a lot of mountain lions.
Yeah, it's almost the entire coast here.
Yeah, so whereas the rest of the western states maintains some type of legal hunt, states vary tremendously in how they apply that hunt. In some states, you could say that overall their populations may be either stable because this hunt is that intense or even slightly decreasing. But overall, in the western United States, I think it's fair to say that they are increasing.
And I think a lot of people in the public who are environmentally aware, they might see some concern with so much, I guess, that we do hunt or that there is some that type of regulation around it. And I think that's why a lot of people would like to see a more passive, like in California, where there's no hunt. I've got questions here for you today that come directly from people in my community. We've had a little family of cougars on the Maristone Island, and there was one male juvenile who had recently been relocated to western Jefferson County, which is, some would argue, a much better place because he can establish a better territory and better hunting area for breeding and for just living out there. Maristone Island is not that big, and black-tailed deer, pretty much the only real food source. I'm not sure exactly how diverse their diets are, but it began to eat livestock, and so they had relocated it. So what is the survival rate for trapped and or tranquilized mountain lions being relocated?
Yeah, if I could go backwards too, I'd like to answer to two of your comments. Directly answer your question. It's relatively unknown. Translocation, or sort of catching an animal that has either ended up in a place that we would not like them, downtown suburbia, hasn't caused any problems, or an animal that has killed livestock, but infrequently enough that the state will allow moving it. Generally, if an animal starts killing livestock, the concern is that if you move it, you're just moving the problem. Mm-hmm. And so it's now going to kill livestock in this new location. So yeah, it might help the residents of Maristone who don't want their livestock killed, but now you've just given another community a problem lion. Yeah. So that's the concern. And so for that concern, or because of it, it's rarely been tried.
Yeah.
But increasingly, especially along the West Coast, and California leading the way, translocation is being pushed by the public. And state agencies are trying it. And they've now been doing this in California as well. I would say that as a scientist, I would love to see, and we did not do this with this recent translocation from Maristone, is we should put a collar on these cats so that we can see if they do survive. What they did is they released it with an ear tag. The ear tag might provide some information later down the road. Yeah. But if it, for instance, gets in a fight with another mountain lion and dies for that reason or of other natural causes, disease, etc., we'll never know.
Or a car.
Yeah, or a car. It just disappears.
Yeah.
But if it's killed by a hunter, we might learn that from the ear tag. Yeah. Maybe from a car, we might learn it that way as well.
Yeah.
But it just might disappear, and so we don't know. If we continue to lack for the data to support translocation, Western states will continue to shoot mountain lions rather than translocate them and give them the opportunity to at least try to establish a new range. If I could take one more minute, I think what you brought up is important. And I would just say that American culture is changing and that this is okay. And what folks have to realize is that, and this is without judgment, I'm not making a judgment here, it's just purely observation. It seems to me that culturally, what's happening in the United States is that you're seeing continued support for hunting for food and reduced support for hunting for a head, a skin, what you might call trophy hunting. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing continued support for hunting of elk and deer and ungulates and reduced support for hunting of carnivores. And this is just a fact. This is not a judgment. This is just what's happening. And so the state agencies are finding themselves having to deal with this new cultural reality. Yeah. And some of them are adjusting quickly, and others are struggling to change fast enough to meet what are now the desires and pressure that's coming from the public.
So what are the best management practices for those who shepherd domesticated animals and livestock? Are dogs effective cougar repellent? And if they are there any specific breeds?
There are definitely things you can do to reduce the chances that a mountain lion would kill your livestock. If you're just a relatively small, let's say, livestock owner, you know, not very many animals, it's so easy to put them in at night, contain them at night, make sure the enclosure has a roof, a fenced roof or something like that, because a cat can come over quite a high fence.
Yeah.
And that's essential. And this, again, I guess from my point of view, I would like to emphasize that living with a mountain lion is a privilege. That second, it is a shared responsibility. We can't just expect mountain lions to behave. You hear that a lot. This is a good mountain lion. It's not causing problems, but it's coexisting with people. Why is it the mountain lion's responsibility to follow certain rules that it has no idea exist?
Yeah.
It should be a shared responsibility. And as someone who lives in mountain lion habitat, you should take it upon yourself to actually caretake your livestock, create pens that are mountain lion proof, keep them in at night. You don't pasture them next to the riparian area where the cats are moving on travel corridors. You keep them closer to your house. And then there are definitely really effective means with guard dogs. A lot of these sheep herding dogs that come from Europe, the Pyrenees, these big white dogs that look like sheep, you can raise them with your sheep. They're almost 100% effective against mountain lions.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carilion bear dogs, which the state of Washington actually has a Carilion bear dog program run by Rich Beausoleil. He's a Department of Fish and Wildlife biologist. And it's incredibly successful at sort of separating mountain lions from people and reducing conflict and hopefully creating greater opportunities for coexistence.
I wanted to talk about it in the last question. I guess in this situation that we were talking about in Maristone, I think what was stated as the reason why it was relocated is because a mountain lion who eats livestock is something that is either injured or he just wasn't able to hunt, I guess, a normal prey like a black-tailed deer. He was resorting to kind of fast food because sheep or whatever livestock may not be as difficult of a prey to catch. So is that true?
I would say no, that is not true. It's one of the myths that you hear circulated to maintain certain management practices. Mm-hmm. And again, it's something we have very little knowledge about. So I shouldn't say no. I should say we don't know.
Okay.
Because the second a mountain lion starts killing livestock, generally it's killed. Boom. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact they translocated, it was actually amazing.
It's
and that's
good.
No doubt
yeah.
that is trying to meet the community in which that mountain lion lived. The community supported that mountain lion. They were enthused about it. There were certainly those who were scared of it and would like to have seen it removed, but there are so many people in Maristone who wanted to see that mountain lion continue to live there.
Yeah.
And the state, they built a bridge with these people and said, we're not going to kill it.
Yeah.
We're going to move it.
Yeah.
And that was sort of a mid-ground. What do they eat? Mountain lions eat all sorts of stuff. Coyotes, you bet.
Yeah.
Beavers, porcupines,
anything. Yeah.
Anything that moves. Certainly they specialize on deer or deer-sized animals, so young elk is a big one if they have the opportunity. And goats and sheep are the perfect size for mountain lions. What I hear is the reason you should kill a mountain lion that kills livestock is that they're going to continue to eat livestock. Like, once you've tasted sheep,
yeah.
you can't go back. You know, you gotta stick with your sheep.
Yeah.
And having worked in Patagonia, where they did kill sheep quite frequently, I can tell you that wasn't true. We had cats that would kill a sheep a month, and in between would eat all wild prey. I think that we just don't know what they do.
We're still
here.
Learning.
Yeah, and that if we gave them the opportunity to continue to live there, we could gather that data. But without the data, again, we just can't make conclusions. So we're basing this management decision based on pressure from the public, whether it's someone who's like, get that cat out of here, that was my prize goat, which is a very legitimate opinion and perspective, or whether you're on the other side of the fence, people saying, don't move this mountain lion. It has every right to live here.
Yeah, he's a resident of
right.
that
Again, a legitimate perspective, but these agencies find themselves caught in the middle of people with opposing views and have to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. I think what people don't sometimes understand is that they think, why would a mountain lion come to a semi to fully developed area and make home here? But I think just my opinion is that they were there the whole time and they've probably been there before there was anything. And so they kind of see it as a native area to them. And I guess some people wonder why they continue to return to highly populated areas where there is less prey and potentially more dangerous interactions. Can you just talk about that briefly?
Yes, historically, that was all mountain lion habitat for sure. But in more recent years, we don't believe there was a mountain lion on Maristone. This is a fairly recent addition. And it's a young male, classic. It's these young males who are sort of pushing the edges. They get pushed out. They need to find new territories if there are already resident males elsewhere. And so they're just finding a home. And lo and behold, this young male found this spot, lots of food, seems like a nice place, plenty of cover, and set up a residence. I will just point you to very brand new research that just came out of the Front Range of Colorado. And they were actually looking at, why does a cat decide to go into someone's backyard where it could hunt deer or raccoon or whatever? And there's certainly food there, so that's not really the issue. But what they found was that these same cats will avoid going in people's backyards until they become hungry. So if they haven't eaten for sort of 4 to 7 days and they're starting to feel empty, they start taking risks. And that risk is approaching a human habitation and potentially encountering people. But in exchange, they gain the opportunity to hunt those grounds, which are often fertile grounds because there's tons of raccoons and skunks and
protect
possums,
black-tailed deer.
And black-tailed deer in everyone's backyard.
Which we've seen here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so if the food's there, they're going to come. It's just they have to be hungry enough to take the risk.
Got a lot more questions for you. You're an expert in tracking and a lot of other really cool things, I think. So hopefully we'll have you back on and we can do another show.
That would be wonderful.
So let's reveal that mystery sound. Hear it one more time. Those bold calls come from a Steller's jay. A Steller's Jay can be easily identified at distance while they scold intruders or communicate amongst each other. Up close, you can observe their deep blue bodies that transition into a black head and crest. Scientists have described 16 subspecies in North and Central America. Generally, adults from the Pacific coast have a blue streak on their black crest. In the interior, they have a white streak, and Central American Steller Jays are bluer overall. Steller and Blue Jays are the only North American bird that have crests. With Blue Jays continuing their range west, the two species now hybridize where populations meet. Although Steller they are, they continue to be the most misspelled among birders. Along with Steller's sea eagle and sea lion, Steller's Jays were named after Russian naturalist George Steller when they were first seen on the Alaskan Islands in 1741. Thank you to Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Macaulay Library and AllAboutBirds.com for the sound recordings and descriptions. For upcoming events, eBird is hosting a global big day on May 5th, 2018. Last year, more than 20,000 people across 162 countries participated in reporting 6,637 species of birds. That figure accounts for more than 60% of the world's bird diversity. Before you start, scout your spot, do a little research, and invite some friends.
Also, there's the 2018 Botanical Symposium, which will be held at the Washington Native Plant Society Wednesday, March 21st at the University of Washington Center for Urban Horticulture.
The Marine Science Center will be opening their Natural History, Marine, and Orca exhibit on Friday, March 30th to the general public. Would you like to talk just briefly about your project in Port Angeles?
We're just launching new mountain lion research west of Port Angeles. This is a collaborative project with the Lower Elwha tribe. And Kim Sager is their sort of lead biologist. And we're starting to monitor mountain lions and hopefully bobcats as well. We just caught our first mountain lion 2 weeks ago.
Looking forward to hearing more about that as well. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Elbrock.
You bet. Well, thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to another episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12.05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5.05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12.30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on KPTZ's website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing today's show is Alabama, singing mountain music.
Oh, play me some mountain music like Grandma.